Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
That justice system ultimately ignored all of those bodies and all of the families.
The stories they don't want told.
I was one of many people that were victims who was used.
Being lied to, tricked, and traded like a commodity.
Holding the powerful to account.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
World of Secrets, the Global Investigations podcast from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Bernadette Keogh. I'm here to introduce you to the Global Story Podcast, which brings you a single story in depth with insight from the BBC's best journalists. There's a new edition every weekday. Just search for the Global Story wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode.
Hello, I'm Katia Adler from the BBC World Service. This is The Global Story. The confirmed deaths of another six of the hostages taken from Israel last October by Hamas has led to Israelis taking to the streets in recent days. They're calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and criticising their prime minister loudly.
We're protesting against the government who never gave us a chance to rescue our beloved ones.
Overseas, even close allies of Israel, like the US president, are ever more bluntly accusing Benjamin Netanyahu of not doing enough to secure a hostage deal. So far, Israel's prime minister appears not to be listening to any criticism coming his way.
Now the world will seriously demand that Israel make concessions after this massacre? What message does this send to Hamas? Murder more hostages, you'll get more concessions.
So will anything, can anything ever change Benjamin Netanyahu's mind and his plans to keep fighting in Gaza, he says, until Hamas is wiped out? With me today is the BBC's international editor, Jeremy Bowen. And I wanted to ask you, Jeremy, I mean, you've been covering the Middle East for years. I've been out there for quite a few years myself and have spoken to Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli premier, a few times. But you have really been able to watch him so much over his very long political career. Tell us about, you know, who is he? When we talk about will Benjamin Netanyahu listen to X, Y or Z, how likely is he to do that? What kind of political animal is he?
Well, he's a political animal who's incredibly good at politics. He's incredibly good at staying in power. With the exception of a fairly brief period of months, he's been Israeli prime minister, I think, about the last 15 years. I used to watch him on TV when he was the ambassador at the United Nations. Very, very articulate spokesman for Israel. Much of his childhood was spent in the United States, which was why he speaks English with such American fluency. When I was based in the 1990s in Jerusalem, Netanyahu became prime minister for the first time in 1996. And it was an election which many Israelis old enough to remember it would say, well, everyone went to bed thinking it was going to be Shimon Peres who'd won. But then a few more votes came in and very narrowly, Benjamin Netanyahu became the prime minister. And it was the time of the Oslo peace process, which he was vehemently opposed to. And while he went along with a lot of American pressure, he was always deeply, instinctively against it. And now, many years later, and in the throes of the most violent episode in the modern history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, any pretense that he had any desire to go in the direction of a two-state solution, a Palestinian state alongside Israel, has gone. He's vehemently said, no chance.
How much is this an ideological politician we're talking about, an ideological leader, and how much, at the end of the day, a pragmatist and survivor? And what's he surviving against, if you can give us a quick picture?
Well, there is always this debate about the degree to which Netanyahu is an ideological man and the degree to which he's a political man. He is definitely highly political, but I think that is underpinned by ideology, much of which he would have got from his father, who was something of a controversial academic, but one very anchored in the hard right of Israeli politics.
Okay, well, let's have a look at the pressures that Benjamin Netanyahu is under. Obviously, there was that Hamas-organized attack inside Israel, unprecedented in scale and bloodiness, largest loss of life inside Israel since the founding of the State of Israel almost a year ago now. The retribution, the military activity of Israel's inside Gaza has been devastating ever since, with Benjamin Netanyahu's aim, he says, that he wants to destroy Hamas, which, you know, governs Gaza and is labelled a terrorist organisation by the West. What about his people, though? I mean, we've seen a general strike this week. Israelis on the street saying, we want a ceasefire. The priority has to be getting our hostages home. It doesn't look like Benjamin Netanyahu is moved by this.
Israel is a very divided country. And the people who are going out on the streets, particularly of Tel Aviv and other places, are very often secular, quite middle class, the kind of people who instinctively would not vote for Netanyahu. He has drawn his support over many, many years, fundamentally from those people who are on the right of Israeli politics. And when we talk about right and left in Israel, it's not about where you stand on the control of the economy or anything like that. The more right-wing Israelis are, the fewer concessions they're prepared to give to Palestinian self-determination, vice versa on the left. Traditionally, there were so-called lefty Israelis who were prepared to go down that road of the two-state solution. And with all the events that have been going on, that's an increasingly small group of people. He's, I think, become very good at riding out a storm. He's someone who one of his essential political tools is playing for time, waiting for something better to turn up. He uses words in a very clever way, sometimes with very different messages in Hebrew to the ones he sends out to the world in English. And he's become quite a past master at that. If you think the position he was in after the 7th of October attacks, when he was widely blamed for a series of gross security errors that led to Hamas having an opportunity, and not least in allowing Hamas to be built up at the expense of the Palestinian Authority on the West Bank, who is a group who are prepared to work with Israel, who'd recognized Israel's existence. But he believed in divide and rule. He felt that they could continue to control Gaza. And it turned out that was not the case. And he is still very adeptly stepping aside from any admissions of responsibility on that. But one thing he does know is that when he stops being prime minister, he will have to face the music.
That's right. And so there are allegations. We heard that from this crowd, which was largely organized by the biggest trade union in Israel. And this is not a new accusation, that Benjamin Netanyahu is not doing his best to try and find a ceasefire with Hamas, because as long as there's conflict in Gaza, he's not facing the music. Also, the judicial music that he might end up facing. That's the accusation.
Yeah, because he's also been on trial over a period of years, and that's now been put on hold because of the war, for really serious corruption charges that could end in a jail sentence. Benny Gantz, prominent opposition politician who did join his war cabinet for a while after October the 7th, he said the other day, hostages must be returned even at a heavy price. Netanyahu, Gantz said, is dealing with political survival and harming strategic relations with the United States. And that message is something that also comes from those demonstrators. But on the other side, and these are the people who Netanyahu is keeping very close, are the leaders of the extreme ultranationalist settler right in Israel. And he has a political alliance with them, which delivered him a parliamentary majority. And the leaders of those groups, there are two gentlemen, they're both cabinet ministers, Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich. Ben-Gvir wrote on X regarding the current negotiations about a ceasefire, because, of course, those hostages were found dead, killed by Hamas in Gaza. That's the Israeli judgment on what happened. A country that has, Ben-Gvir wrote on X, a country that has six of its hostages murdered in cold blood doesn't hold negotiations with the murderers, but it stops the negotiations, stops giving them fuel and electricity, crushes them until they're defeated. So while there are people on the streets, what matters to Netanyahu is that there are people in the government who continue to support him and keeping him in office. And Ben-Gvir and his associate and sometime rival, Smotrich, have both said that if he goes down the road of making deals that they believe are surrender, they will topple his government. And Netanyahu, it's clear, wants to stay in power.
Of course. So to summarise, he has political pressure from the extreme right in Israeli politics. So he prefers to listen to them than the people on the street. But how divided are the people of Israel, Jeremy? Could it get to a point where those angry with Netanyahu, demanding a change in his military policy right now in Gaza, at least for a temporary ceasefire to get the hostages out, they could topple him as well?
Well, they could only topple him with parliamentary support. And the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, is actually on an extended summer recess till just about a week before the US elections. There are signs that Netanyahu is trying to just keep things going until the US elections, when I think, of course, he'll be hoping that Donald Trump wins. And Donald Trump was very friendly to him in his last administration.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor to have Prime Minister Netanyahu, a great friend of mine and a great friend of our country. We've had a tremendous, almost three-year relationship. I've known you for many years before that, but this was 3 years of prime time, and we've done a lot for Israel. And
the latest poll by the public broadcaster CAN shows a majority of Israelis do want that hostage deal, but it's not overwhelming. 53% support withdrawal from the Philadelphia corridor, which is the strip of land between the southern part of Gaza and Egypt, which is becoming one of the big sticking points in the negotiation. In a hostage deal, 29% believe Israel should stay in that corridor, even if it means no hostage deal. And about 50% have no confidence in the Prime Minister, Netanyahu, as a war leader. So that shows, I think, more than anything, there are huge divisions in the country, political divisions, cultural divisions as well, divisions about lifestyle, divisions about the obligations that Israeli citizens owe to their country, about who, for example, should do military service. At the moment, the ultra-Orthodox community don't really have to do it, and people in the secular community who are bearing the brunt of all the reserve duty they've had to do are saying, well, hang on a minute, that's not fair. All these things, there are loads of issues which cleave the country right in two. And I think the future of Netanyahu and the possible ceasefire and what the heck happens after there's a ceasefire, those are very, very divisive issues.
So Israel divided, but not enough for Netanyahu to feel unbearable heat.
He's not going to just say, I've had enough, I'm going out the door. That's against everything that he's ever stood for in his entire career. But the way it works is that he has to lose a vote of confidence in the parliament. The parliament's not even going to reassemble until the end of October. So he's got a breathing space here. His political foundations right now are looking pretty stable, despite those demos on the streets.
Right, so that's the situation inside Israel. What about close allies outside Israel? Number one, of course, the United States. How effective can their words be on Israel's premier?
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at relations between China and Africa. Nearly a decade ago, China promised to provide 10,000 remote villages in Africa with free TV access. It was a sign of warm relations, as well as a chance for Beijing to expand its influence in the continent. But did it work? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Global Story. We bring you one big international story in detail 5 days a week. Follow or subscribe wherever you listen. With me is the BBC's international editor, Jeremy Bowen. What about the international pressure? Because allies of Israel are clearly disturbed by the death toll in Gaza, you know, 41,000 and more increasing. So on Monday, we heard US President Joe Biden saying he didn't think that Mr. Netanyahu was doing enough to reach a deal.
Mr. President, do you think it's time for Prime Minister Netanyahu to do more on this issue? Do you think he's doing enough?
No.
And Kamala Harris, since becoming the Democratic presidential nominee, has told Mr. Netanyahu it is time to end the conflict.
I also expressed with the Prime Minister my serious concern about the scale of human suffering in Gaza, including the death of far too many innocent civilians.
How at the end of its tether is the U.S. With all this? Does it have a tether when it comes to Israel?
I don't think Joe Biden does. I think he's regretful and probably resentful about the way that Netanyahu is not doing as he's told. But if you think back to just the couple of weeks after the October 7th attacks, Biden flew in to Israel. He put his arms around Benjamin Netanyahu, a man with whom he has not gone on well over the years. He's known him for a very long time. And he offered Israel emotional, political, military, diplomatic support. But what he also said was, do not get blinded by fury and anger and the desire for vengeance as we in the US were blinded after 9/11. You have a right to defend yourself, but you have to do it in the correct way. But the point is that Netanyahu basically didn't listen because, and I think this is critical, the US does potentially have levers which are more powerful than words. And the biggest two levers are diplomatic support and military supplies. And with the exception of one or two fairly token delays, the Americans have continued to funnel in loads and loads, dozens of flights of heavy lift aircraft bringing in the weapons and the ammunition that Israel needs. And I think that while Joe Biden continues to be critical of Israel, but then continues to give them all the military supplies that they need, it renders what he says hollow.
I mean, actions speak louder than words, as you say. I wonder what you think that as we get closer to the US election, there are lots of voters in the Democratic camp who, according to polls, may choose to stay at home because of those ongoing weapons deliveries, for example. Do you think the Democrats might be tempted to make a bigger move, to actually take action to warn Israel?
Well, I somehow doubt it, because Joe Biden is still the president. He describes himself as an Irish Catholic Zionist. His attachment to Israel, really Israel right or wrong, runs very, very deep. And so while there are things happening, not least the massive death toll of civilians in Gaza and the humanitarian catastrophe, as Kamala Harris and others have called it, while that goes on and they deeply regret it. And what's more than that, they also are very well aware of the potential political consequences in the US electoral process. I don't see them changing their views on Israel, because being close to Israel and being the ultimate support and protector of Israel is deeply embedded in the political DNA of not just most American politicians, but many, many American voters.
And if in the US we don't see action rather than words warning Benjamin Netanyahu, then what impact can other smaller, less significant allies in terms of economic and military support make on the situation and on changing Benjamin Netanyahu's military policy? I'm thinking about, you know, European countries like Spain, Ireland and Norway joining others in recognizing Palestinian statehood, or the UK, as it's done recently, suspending not many, frankly, arms contracts with Israel. Does he care about any of this? South Africa at the International Court of Justice saying Israel's committing genocide in Gaza. Does this make a drop in Benjamin Netanyahu's sort of policy pond?
He pushes back very, very hard against all of that. He was scathingly condemnatory about Britain's decision to pause a number of arms contracts, aided as well and supported by crucial Western allies. He has absolutely condemned the actions in the international judicial system. He personally faces, along with Defense Minister Gallant, he faces a potential arrest warrant in the International Criminal Court. And Israel has been reported to the International Court of Justice for alleged crimes of genocide. So there's a lot of international pressure building. Does it make a difference to him? No, I think Netanyahu quite likes the pressure because he digs in. However, undoubtedly, it's politically difficult because Israel and his critics inside, Netanyahu's critics inside Israel, make this point. They say Israel is getting more and more isolated. And while it has a very strong relationship with the US, then perhaps it can afford to be to a point. But equally, it's becoming a much more isolated country than it was, you know, in living memory of people who are probably in their 30s.
I wonder if we could delve into a little bit of history, Jeremy, because when it comes to pressure bearing down on Benjamin Netanyahu, the one he most would care about is the powerful ally, the United States. But there have been presidents over the years that have taken a tougher line against Israel, haven't there?
Absolutely. Harry Truman, who was president in 1948 when Israel declared independence, was a big supporter. But then later on in the 1950s, the 1956 Suez War, Israel occupied the Sinai Peninsula and showed every sign of wanting to keep it from Egypt. And President Eisenhower told them to get out. They had to pull back, and they did. It was only really the 1967 war that made the Americans think that Israel might become a very worthwhile military ally because of the nature of Israel's crushing defeat of Syria and Egypt, who were allied with the Soviet Union. So it was after 67 that the Americans became the main supplier. But even back in the early 90s, there was pressure from the U.S. on Israel. There were famously, under the presidency of the first President George Bush.
Peace is vital here, and we worked too hard to have that request of mine denied. And I,
you know, they put pressure on Israel. They also stopped funding when they thought that funding was going to be spent on settlements.
And I'm up against some powerful political forces, but I owe it to the American people to tell them how strongly I feel about deferral.
But in the years since then, and partly I think this is because of post 9/11, this feeling that Israel was very much in the Western camp, and the way that politics have evolved in the United States. Now the U.S. absolutely routinely would use its veto at the Security Council to protect Israel, and they are much more Israel always in the right. One of the longtime peace negotiators in the Oslo process, famously, he said that, looking back on the failures of the peace negotiations, he said, you know, looking back on it, we were just too often, we were Israel's attorney. We were their lawyer. We weren't really intermediaries in the way that we might have been. We were essentially representing them. And I think that certainly continues. And if you speak to any Palestinian I've spoken to, they'll say, well, hang on a minute. The West roundly condemns Russia for what it does in Ukraine, yet they barely criticize what Israel does in Gaza and the West Bank. And Palestinians would say, and, you know, Israel would absolutely reject this, and so would its allies. Palestinians would say, what is the difference, actually?
If we return to the question we were looking at right at the beginning of this episode, can any effective pressure be brought to bear on Benjamin Netanyahu to alter his military strategy in Gaza and keep insisting he won't stop till Hamas is wiped out? If international pressure from his allies isn't working and domestic pressure isn't working on him, ultimately, does it come down to Benjamin Netanyahu when he decides? Does it come back to that, Jeremy, that he'll get to a point where it's no longer working for him and only then will he change?
In a way, this whole thing comes down to two men, to Benjamin Netanyahu and to the leader of Hamas, Yahya Sinwar, who is, we assume, in some hiding place in Gaza, Israel's public enemy number one, the guy they want to kill most. I think that what might bring an end to this war, or the phase of this war, will be if Netanyahu can have a symbol of victory. And the principal one would be the killing of Yahya Sinwar. If they could kill him and say, look, we have now cut off the head of the snake, we've cut off the heads of the replacement snakes, as assistant commanders and so on, we can now say we can declare victory. Other things as well might affect the calculations, not just of Netanyahu, but of his Western allies. And a principal one would be, what if there is that much feared, hot, wider regional war, which the region has been teetering on the brink of repeatedly? There is a lower level wider regional war, but it could get so much worse. That as well would change calculations greatly. So there are circumstances which will change things. But I think at the moment, it is events like that rather than pressure that might change the calculations for Benjamin Netanyahu, who, you know, over a very long political career, he's the longest serving Israeli prime minister, longer than Ben-Gurion, the founding prime minister. He has shown that what he has more than anything else is an incredible instinct for political survival.
Do you feel that even though the US and others have been unsuccessful in changing Netanyahu's military policy over Gaza, they have had success in recent times in staying his hand somewhat when it comes to action against Iran, even though there have been some audacious events, if you like, that this fear of the wider war, which would have a massive economic impact on the West, never mind anything else, is something that's causing them to speak in much sharper tones to Mr. Netanyahu behind closed doors?
Yeah, there have been massive diplomatic efforts to try to calibrate Israel's response to things that have been done to it, which have been seemingly effective. I think the thing to remember is that neither Iran and its friends nor the Israelis and their friends want to have that regional war. They all recognize how potentially catastrophic it would be. But at the same time, I do get the sense that Netanyahu is prepared at times to push the envelope and to do things which his Western backers certainly would feel very uncomfortable about. I'm thinking perhaps of the assassination of the Hamas political leader, Ismail Haniyeh. That was something which Israel chose to do. You know, Netanyahu, I think, is a person who over the years has absolutely convinced himself that he is actually vital to the security of Israel. He talks a lot about the protection of the Jewish people, and I think it's something he believes. I mean, I don't think he's an entirely cynical man at all. He has deep beliefs about all of this, and he believes that he's the man who can protect the Israelis like no other, who can juggle their allies, who can get them where they need to be, who can be tough when necessary, who can make sure that the money's coming in to and the external political support to back what Israel needs to do. And at the same time, he fights political fires inside his own country. But he's that person who, in his own mind, I think, he really believes that he can do this like nobody else.
Thank you, Jeremy.
It's a pleasure.
And thanks to you for listening. If you want to get in touch, you can email us at theglobalstory@bbc.com, or you can send us a message or voice note on WhatsApp. Our number is +44 330 123 9480. And you can find those details in our show notes. Wherever you're listening in the world, this has been The Global Story. Thanks for having us in your headphones. Goodbye.
If you enjoyed listening to The Global Story and would like to hear more, there's a new episode every weekday. Just search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts, and be sure to click subscribe or follow. We'll have another edition of The Global News podcast later. Until then, goodbye.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at relations between China and Africa. Nearly a decade ago, China promised to provide 10,000 remote villages in Africa with free TV access. It was a sign of warm relations, as well as a chance for Beijing to expand its influence in the continent. But did it work? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.